WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I'm going to tell you a couple of incidents about this show before throwing it open for questions. And one is that I just couldn't keep away from making a political film for some reason. I'm just crazy enough to make stories about politics. We had such a a time when Mr. Smith goes to Washington. They practically ran us out of Washington for making that picture. The Senate voted 96-0 that it was the worst picture that was ever made. Fortunately, the people thought otherwise. But another one of 8 years later. It's a much tougher picture than Mr. Smith goes to Washington. This is much more cynical. This is backstage, Sockham kind of a thing. You see how the politics are backstage, and they're not very pretty. And I thought, well, if they didn't like Mr. Smith goes to Washington, they're certainly not going to like this one. So when I get an invitation from MGM that they are opening this film at Lowe's in Washington, and that I, through them, had invited President Truman to be president of the opening, well, I said to my wife, we just better leave the country. That's all there is to it right now. But they made it. They said, you can't. You've got to come because the president has said he will come. I mean, you can't come. So we came to the opening, and when President Truman with his daughter were the guests. And we waited for them outside, the White House correspondent and I, and all the people were inside. And then he came out, got out of his car, and we escorted him to a loge seat, and he sat next to my wife, and I was supposed to sit next to him, right behind him, to explain anything he couldn't understand. I was never so frightened in my life. The title went on, the picture started. I couldn't stay in that loge. I crept out. The security men all around knew where I was, and I went outside to walk up and down, because this is going to be a fiasco. The minute this man hears these jokes about himself, he's going to raise hell, and he's president of the United States. Well, it didn't turn out that way. After a couple of, I heard some laughing going on, and I said, what are they laughing at? They can't be laughing at this thing. So I went up to peek into the loge where the president was sitting, and one of the Secret Service men there says to me, he says, he likes it. And I says, how can you tell he likes it? He says, well, whenever he likes something, he jumps up and down like this. So there was a Truman gag coming. I knew it was coming right here on the screen. And I waited to see that. And there, here comes this gag about Truman. And he jumped up. And I really couldn't understand the whole business. This film, Mr. Truman took with him to his boat and ran it, and kept it for a month, ran it for his friends. And his campaign manager came to Hollywood some years later to speak to us about this, and he told us that it was this film that made up his mind to run against Dewey for another term. Win or lose, he wasn't going to quit. This last speech of Watch Collins was too much for him. And it was a wonderful thing to know that a film could have that effect on a man to make him run for president, and then of course I think we're all very happy they did run and did make those wonderful decisions that he did make. So if that is so, and all we have is his word for it, I'm very, very proud of the fact that this film helped President Truman make up his mind to run. There's one more incident I must tell you about this thing that is, I think, of general, rather general interest to you, might be. I was very happy to make this film at MGM, and it was Friday afternoon. The picture would start on Monday. The picture would start with the two leading parts. The two leading parts at that moment were Spencer Tracy and Claudette Colbert. Miss Colbert comes in at 5 o'clock that evening and in my office, and she looks very pert and she looks very cute. And I say, "Well, are you ready?" And she says, "Yes." But she says, just one more thing. My doctor says that I must quit every day at 5 o'clock. And I said, "Well, my darling, that I can't let you do that because it isn't in your contract, first of all." She says, "Well, we put it in the contract. That's when my doctor says I have to quit." Her doctor is her husband. And she says that her agent also told her that she must do that. Her agent was her brother. And I was so mad that this last minute, this gal puts this thing on, and she insisted. And I said, "Well, I can't do that. This is going to cost a lot of money. I can't let you go at 5 o'clock. What about the rest of the cast? I have to quit with everybody." She said, "Well, that's your business." So I said, "Well, is that, what's the or else?" She says, "Or else I don't play the film." I said, "Okay, you don't play the film. You're out. Check in your wardrobe." She had her wardrobe was already made Friday. And here we are, Friday afternoon, the weekend coming, the picture starts Monday morning. Everybody goes on salary Monday morning. I have no leading lady. And I tell one of my partners and he goes crazy. I tell the MGM production people and they go crazy. They don't know where to go. I finally called Spencer Tracy. I said, "Spencer, this is what I've done." "Why," he says, "you damn little dago, you. I'm gonna turn you in. What do you mean?" So I said, "Spencer, I just flipped my lid. I couldn't take that, I'm sorry. Do you happen to have any friends?" "I mean women. I mean actresses that aren't working, good actresses." "You know, that bag of bones has been rehearsing these lines with me, and Frank, she stops you." And I said, do you think she'd do it? Do you think she? He's talking about Hepburn, of course. And she says, "I don't know. Don't say a word about me talking to you. But I can tell you one thing, she's theater. You tell her something about the theater's in trouble and she's a crazy dame. She's allowed to do anything." I call her up and I tell her exactly what happened, word for word. I said, "We're in trouble, Katie. What about it?" She says, "You just wait right there. Wait right there. I'll get my dressmaker. We'll come down to your house. We'll make the fake first dress. We'll be ready." And she comes right down, and we spend the whole weekend, and she makes her first few dresses for her costume. And she doesn't want to know her billing, her salary, nothing. Ask for nothing. And Monday morning, We all show up bright and early, and the first scene goes on, and it's with Mr. Spencer Tracy and Miss Catherine Hepburn. And everything went on just as fine. What might have been disaster certainly turned into serendipity. We got the picture that we have, and I was never happier to have such a cast as I had there. To watch Tracy and Hepburn play a scene is simply merely to sit down and open your mouth and gape and listen and learn. They do it so wonderfully. So I love this picture for many, many reasons, and I'm very happy that you love it tonight. Now, if you have any questions further, I would be delighted to try to answer them as best I can.
Yes, I'd like to ask Mr. Capra what he thinks of some of the new directors that have come onto the scene in the past couple of years, like George Lucas or Steven Spielberg and some people like that.
I think they're wonderful. I think they're phenomenal. They're a new phenomenon. Here's Spielberg, under 30, has made two blockbusters already. Wonderful. Never happened before that young kids could come in now and make these great pictures. And it's a great tribute to many of the film schools that they've attended. These kids have all come from film schools and gone right on and added this wonderful dimension of new imagination that they have. And I think they're a tremendous addition to what we've been doing, and they are certainly taking our minds off of this brutality and pornography that we've been having. And there's a brand new thing has come in, new blood that thinks differently and thinks widely and thinks more imaginatively than we have. And I think the best pictures are yet to come, and they will come from these kids.
How did you come to the screenplay of State of the Union? Was it written for you? Was it given to you? How did you come upon it?
I saw it in the theater. This was written for the theater. And played very well by Ralph. I think Ralph Bellamy played the part. And I just fell in love with the whole idea. So I bought the theatrical rights and we made a film out of it.
The question is, who are your favorite actors and actresses?
That's rather an unfair question to ask, because there are no two of them alike. Yeah, no two would play the same part alike, so that you can never get a comparison of them playing the same part. And they are as different from each other as each individual is different from every other individual. All have their own ways of doing things, all have their own ways of demonstrating their artistry. It's most difficult to say this is the best, this actor is better than this actor, and that actress is better than that actress. In certain parts that they play, one actor will be just wonderful, and this one will be another one. Yeah. I don't think I can make any comparison and rate them according to some kind of a rating. I can only tell you that I think actors are the most important part of the motion picture. They everything else is subject to them. Everything else is machinery. They're the ones that are in direct contact with the audience. It's people-to-people communication, and they are the most important tools, if I can use the word, that you have in making a motion picture. To compare them, you're not going to get me to say this actor is better than the other one, because that is not so. I've seen performers give little parts like that, make little gems, and do wonderful work. This woman here, this woman here plays the drum, does a wonderful part, very small little part. How can you say that somebody's she's better or worse than anybody else? actors are wonderful people. They give they brighten and they lighten the lives of millions and millions of people, and that's it's a great profession. And I have great respect and great love for all actors. I don't care whether they're big or they're little. I can't answer your question. Yes, we did. We had quite a bit of difficulty. We couldn't find an ending that would please. We just wrote ourselves into a corner and couldn't get out. We couldn't find an ending to end it, certainly not to my satisfaction. And I think that for 7/8 of that picture, that's one of the finest pictures ever made as far as I'm concerned. And then it just falls over like a wet sock at the end. something is wrong at the end. Something is wrong. We can never get discovered. Well, it's very funny, in a sense, because at one time we had three endings playing, one in San Francisco, one in New York, and one in Washington. Three different kinds of endings, hoping that the audience would tell us which ending of those three they'd like the best. No, all three of them are lousy. So then I get a letter. Now the picture's open. It's playing in the theaters. We're these various endings in, and we trying to make up our minds which ones to use. And we get a letter signed John Doe, which says, "You stupid people, the only way you can keep that man from jumping off of that building is if the John Does themselves ask him not to." Boing. We hadn't thought of that one. So I called all the cast back. Go back to the Ice House, because we were playing in 15-degree weather to run to get the breath show, and made shoot the ending, that ending that was suggested by this anonymous letter that came signed John Doe. That's the ending that's in the picture now. That's the ending we accepted. We accepted an ending that was written to us by a fan from the outside. That's how smart we are. You know.
The question is there a story that you wanted the film that you haven't?
Oh, yes, everybody wants to do, like everybody wants to play Hamlet. I mean, I want to do very much this story of Cervantes, life of Cervantes. I want to do very much the story about the man with the long nose, Sir Cyrano. I want to do that. The dreams. When it came right down to whether I wanted to do it and should do it and start spending money on it and making money, I'd draw back, because I'd find myself out of my own element. My element was the American scene. I knew Americans and I knew the scene. I knew how Americans thought, how Americans spoke. I knew what to do with Americans. I knew that they would represent the Americans, the all America. I didn't know how Frenchmen would act. I didn't know how Russians would act. So I was too either too smart or too crazy or too scared to go out of my own strength. And my strength was the American scene, so I stayed with it.
We're back. Yes.
What was it like working under Mr. Cohen?
Well, it was like nothing that you ever imagined. It was certainly not dull. I think he's one of the greatest men I've ever met in many, many ways. He was all the bastards he was ever called, he was that. He was all the names he was ever called, he was that. He was crude, but he loved films with a passion. And he ran his studio and ran it up from a small, rinky-dink little skid row studio up into a major studio by one very crude parameter. If he could bully you, he didn't want you around. Now, he didn't care who you were. He didn't care how big your name was. If he could bully you, he didn't want you spending his money. I found this out very early, so I became his cockiest employee, and he never won an argument with me, ever. And it was, if he ever did win one argument, my stock would go down. Now, I won every argument, even though I knew I was wrong. And even I know he knew I was wrong. And even though he knew, I knew that I was wrong. It was a great game between us. If I ever admitted that he knew something about films better, more than I did, he would lose confidence in me. And even though he was right. And he got a great kick out of me seeing me get out of a situation in which I was wrong. And he really enjoyed it, you know, seeing me squirm this way and then, and how I finally made myself right. And he enjoyed that whole process, and he loved me for it, and had more confidence in me for that. This was life at Harry Cohen's. You had to be right all the time.
I noticed that the children in the film gave very good performances. How is working with children different from adults?
How is working with children different from adults?
How is working for children different from adults?
Yeah.
Working for children is just a breeze, working with children. All children are fine actors. They are all natural actors. They start acting from the year one, they start acting. And they are play acting all the time anyway. So they are wonderful little actors. They learn all their lines. They know everything. They know. There isn't a child that's normal that isn't a fine actress or a fine actor until they reach the age of 12, 13 perhaps. Then they become self-conscious. And the minute they become self-conscious, away goes all that wonderful naturalness that children have, and all that wonderful play-acting ability they have, and all that wonderful joy it is for them to play-act. And they begin thinking of themselves, how they look, how their hair is, in other words, they become young adults. And when you're an adult, you lose that a wonderful feeling of childhood that knows no evil, hears no evil, and thinks everything is just bright and rosy, and the world is fine, and everything is just right, and the play acting is fun. At that age, most children cannot go on. They do not go on. They act very badly from that time on. They become very, 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 very few child stars continue on beyond the age of puberty. Very, very, very few.
Is your hand up there? Yes.
What sort of difficulties did you encounter filming the air sequences in that movie?
Filming? Wait, what?
The air sequences, the airplane.
What difficulties was?
Well, we just went up and shot them. we had some good pilots, some excellent pilots, and we went up and shot them. They're not too hard. You'd be surprised what those pilots can do up there. You'd be like bumping the wings and things like that. That's none of that is very hard. None of that is very. It looks pretty difficult, but none of that is very very difficult for good pilots. And as for jumping out of planes and parachutes, that's done every day. And no, that was rather fun, rather easy to shoot. No problem.
Yes. Yes. Did you start out intending to become a director in films?
When? At what age?
My question is, when did you, how and when did you decide that you?
I didn't have much to do with the decision, dear. I graduated from Caltech as a chemical engineer. After World War I, and I got out, I was in that. Army, and I got out of the Army, I couldn't find a job. I didn't find a job for a long, long, long time. And I was really on the bum for 3 or 4 years, just going up and down the western coast, western states, making my living as best I could. And at one time I was in San Francisco, and I was kicked out of my room because I couldn't pay the $18 rent that I owed, and I read in the paper that somebody was starting a new motion picture company out at Golden Gate Park. The fact that somebody was starting something new gave me an idea, well, if I get there quick enough, I might be able to get a job as a driver or sweeper or some damn thing. And I went out there and I met just one gentleman who was in charge of the whole thing, and I introduced myself as Frank Capra from Hollywood. it was not altogether a lie. Los Angeles was my home, but I'd never been inside of a studio. Well, he fell over because he had never been inside of a studio either. And he thought that God had sent me. to help him. So he asked me to help him make this first film that he was trying. And that's how it started.
Yeah.
What company was it?
Who was that?
This company that you started with, did it evolve into any larger company, or did it fold? Who were they that you started with?
The person I was talking about in that was a vaudeville actor by the name of Montague, who had started a little company, who had gotten some help and some financing, local financing, to start a small company there in San Francisco. That's all I know about the business end of it. I got $75 for the whole job.
Mr. Capra, in the film we just saw, there were a number of references to communist influence in the country. I was wondering, would you change any of those references now, or any other aspect of them?
Oh, I doubt it. I think you find the same kind of attitudes among people. You find political differences right now just as good at any other time. Sometimes they're stronger than others, but they're. We're a democracy. We have everything here. Whatever you want, we have. And that's the way it should be. I think we should be allowed to think any way we want. You want to be a communist? Be a communist. So what? But as long as you make do everything in a democratic way, that's fine. Well, Frank Sinatra has been called many, many things and been, there's one difficulty with Frank Sinatra that only very few people know, and that is that he can only do a scene once, And then if he has to do it again, it bores him. He is a saloon singer, as he calls himself. He sings to people, but he doesn't sing to the same people. He doesn't sing the same song twice to the same audience. So when he's working in films and he has to do a scene over and over again for the same audience, whatever everybody always is, light men, whatever there is around there, it bores him and annoys him. He is not the kind of an actor that wants to rehearse and find new things. He is a one-man shot. He's got it all to begin with. He's probably the greatest entertainer that ever came on the scene in every way, acting, singing, humor. He's got it all. So if you want him to shine his best or do his best scenes, and of course every director, you must try to get the best performance out of every person you can. You get the best performance out of Frank Sinatra the first time he does the scene. Second time you get a worse one, third time you get nothing. So I ran into a very, very odd situation in the picture I made with Frank Sinatra, because with Frank Sinatra was an actor by the name of Eddie Robinson, who was stage trained, who wanted to rehearse all day, and who got better as he rehearsed. As he went along, he'd do the scene once, he'd do it again, and he found little things to do. He added a little bit here, a little bit there, and he found that he built his part just by rehearsing. He got better with each rehearsal. Frank Sinatra got worse. And this became a real problem, how to work with these two people, because Mr. Robinson insisted that Sinatra rehearse with him. And I finally said, I can't rehearse him with you. He said, why not? Every actor. I said, well, no, not every actor, not this actor. This guy will leave it. So we had quite a bit of problem getting these two people together until they each found out exactly why. And then they were great together. But they never did rehearse together. They played the scene together. And I usually, of course, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine with me, because I think the first scene is always the best. And unless some mechanical thing goes wrong, unless there's some technical thing that goes wrong, the roughness, the narrowness, the feeling of that the actors are speaking at the wrong part at the wrong time and not exactly at the right time and all this, that is exactly how it is in real life. And that is the way you speak in real life. You never finish a sentence in real life without somebody butting in on. And you ever hear three or four women talk together? They're all talking at one time. And they're all understanding each other. I don't know how, but the first time the actors do that take is probably, for me, the most natural time. The take that will sound the most natural. It will not be the most perfect take, technically. It will not be the most perfect take for them. But on the whole, it'll be the most realistic take that you can take, that you'll have. It'll sound more like real life than if you go on refining and refining and refining until you get perfection from everybody. So that's, I like actors who do their best in their first take, because then I won't have to go do a second take with them.
Well, Mr. Capra, I think that of all directors that have ever lived, I think you're the greatest master of the reaction shot. I think that, well, you can tell more with one reaction shot than with any other piece of dialogue, whether it be by Mr. Riskin or anybody else. How did you develop that particular skill?
Well, that particular skill is you learn when you work at places like Max Sennett's, and you had to work in pantomime, and you had to work in visual comedy. Now, the reactive character is very, 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 very important. You must be in the business or you wouldn't know what a reactive character is.
Explain.
A reactive character is a person who looks on while a scene is being played, that's all. And it's his reaction to a scene that is like what the audience's reaction would be, you see, most likely, more like. And if you're playing a scene that's a little bit edgy, that you they might laugh at the scene, you play, go to a reactive character and ask for a laugh from the audience with a take-em scene from a reactive character. And you will then be in safe ground. You will be asking for an audience, and the audience will laugh. But if the audience then laughs not at you, but laughs at the story. So the reactive character is a most useful kind of a character for those who make films, and not many people quite know how to use them.
Take a few more questions. Yeah, back there. Okay. Question is, of all the films you've made, which one has meant the most to you? Which theme has meant the most to you?
Oh, dear. That is another one of those which one. I know you have reasons for asking this which and why you want to know, but it troubles me. Why you want to know which best actor, which why? But you must be curious about these things, or you wouldn't ask the question. I can only tell you that my favorite film, not necessarily I think my best film, in the sense that I've done my best work. I think this here is one of my best work, in the sense as a director did my best work. My favorite scene is It's a Wonderful Life. Mainly because I think it says what I've been trying to say a long time, many times in other films. It says it better than I'd ever said it before. The freedom of man and the importance of the individual. It brings those two things together in a plot that I'd never read or heard before, and that is that a man who thinks he's a failure is given the opportunity to come back and see his own little world. How it would have been had he not been born, and he finds out that he is not a failure, that nobody is a failure, that everybody that has one friend is a rich man, and everybody who has three friends is filthy rich, and that particular film I think for theme wise, for saying what I've been trying to say about the importance of man and about the importance of the freedom of man, does it better than any other film that I've ever made.
Take one more question. Yes, gentlemen, middle there. Yes.
Mr. Capra, I recall your submarine picture. This was during the Depression years, and I had a great deal of difficulty to get 25 cents admission and 14 cents car fare. However, I did go to see your picture. I saw it on two occasions. And I have read King Kong and your biography on how you made that picture. Perhaps you could say a few words concerning Jack Holt and the submarine picture. I think it was called Men Without Women. That's 48 years ago.
I suppose I could say something about all pictures. But one thing I can say about that picture that I replaced a director on that picture. I replaced a director that had a name, and I had been making nothing but Z pictures, very short little things, and I was replacing an A picture director, and a great friend of Jack Holt. They were great friends. I was in a very tough spot to walk into that kind of a spot, and I knew I had to do something quite dramatic in order to gain the respect of everybody who loved the other gentleman. He was a fine, his name was Irving Willett, and he was well known and he was well loved, but he just didn't get along. Harry Cohen just didn't trust him any longer. And he wanted one of his cocky little guys to go down there and finish this thing. And I had to think up something that dramatic, as I say. So the only thing I could think of was that I made all the actors take off their makeup. This got the biggest howl you have ever heard in the world. From the actors, from the cameraman. The cameraman say their faces will be different colors, everything, all that kind of stuff. No makeup. Everybody take off their makeup. I've never seen sailors with their makeup. I don't know. You look like you look like fairies to me with the makeup. Take off all your makeup. Or else I leave this picture. I leave it. I'm the hell with it. I don't want any part of it. With that one stroke of a piece of arrogance on my part, I gained a certain amount of respect. And finally, I said to these two, to Jack Holt, who was absolutely going to quit the picture, I said, Mr. Holt, let's shoot one day. No makeup, and you can see the one day's rushes. If you don't like it, I'll leave. If you do like it, we'll go on. So we left it at that. We did it a day's work without makeup. I gave him a chew of tobacco in his mouth, and I made a sailor out of the man, and took that little thing out of his head. He had a little toupee here, and I just undressed him and made him look like a sailor. And he saw it on the screen, and he was terribly worried about how he would look as a star, and he loved it. So I remember he drove up. He came up to the shore. He came up to a pier on a small little boat to tell me. And from that little boat, he says, "Don't go away, don't go away." So he liked it, and I stayed on. That's one little scene I can remember. I could tell you others, but perhaps there are other questions that somebody might like to have about this picture. Let's take one more question.
One more, sure. Over there?
Yeah. Mr. Kavanaugh, I know that you went back and remade some of your earlier films, and that others attempted to do that also. And I was wondering what your opinion is of remaking films.
There is no law against it, certainly. There might have to be one pass. But pictures have been remade successfully. Not many, but successfully enough I think very little. I don't think it's a very profitable business at all to remake it for anybody. First of all, I think it's unethical. Morally, you're trying to capitalize on somebody else's creativity. There you got two strikes against you morally right off the bat. Then you will have this comparison, bound to have a comparison, particularly if you're trying to remake a very successful film. You're bound to have a comparison. And unless you have made a very fine film, you'll lose out in the comparison. So the odds against you making a successful remake of something that is well known and something that has been well done and loved are very much against you. I think it's just poor business to do it, nothing else. And I couldn't even, I remade a couple of my own pictures and didn't do a very good job. And I don't think they were as good as the first ones. So nobody knows exactly why a picture is a hit. It just is. And nobody knows what makes a hit. And nobody can predict what will be a hit. No matter what you read about, how much money is spent, and how much this, this, and that, and that, and that, nobody can predict that anything that is made, no matter how much money is spent, will be a hit. Nobody can predict what the audience wants. Now, this is the trouble now. We have now, instead of showmen who know this, showmen all know this, but we have corporation lawyers or sons of lawyers or sons of corporation heads who are running now the companies in New York, and they are business-minded, and the business mind is to try to make a model that'll sell and then make copies of that models. Well, that does not work in films. Nobody wants to make have a copy of another film, because they see one good film with a building burning. They don't want to see a succession of films with building burnings. They don't. The trend is the worst thing. If you follow a trend, that's the quickest way of going broke. If you start a trend, that's the quickest way of making money. So I think it's not only unethical, I think it's bad business to try to remake hits.
Thank you, Mr. Capra, for coming to Philadelphia.